one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
Swung on,
did it,
crushed, and the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out.
From WHYY, it is hitting season. Hey there, podcast pals. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on X and Blue Sky at John Stolness. Coming up, what a weekend. What a week. What a homestand for the Phillies. Winners of 9 in a row. Sweepers of 3 straight series for the first time since 2010. And they are the hottest team in baseball as they get ready for a long West Coast road trip against some American League teams. Capped off by an incredible win on Sunday afternoon against the Cardinals at Citizens Bank Park. We're going to get into all of it here on this edition of Hittin' Season. We'll talk a little Jesus Luzardo. We'll talk a little Andrew Painter. In fact, we've got 5 Phillies topics, 5 big Phillies talk. It's the Phillies 5 we're going to give you with regards to this 9-game winning streak and this homestand we just saw. Tremendous stuff from the Phils. Joining me here on this edition of the Roundtable, a little bit smaller of a table this week as we do not have Liz Rocher with us, but Justin Clue of Baseball Prospectus is here. He, of course, is the host of a couple of our podcasts over at the Hittin' Season Patreon called The Dirty Inning and Absolutely Hammered. He's also author of the new book, Summer of the Cheap Wieners. You've heard us talk about it a million times. If you haven't gotten it by now, I don't know what your problem is, but you need to run out to the store and get it. Follow him on Blue Sky at Justin Clue. Justin, man, oh man, what a week of baseball. What a weekend. What a Sunday.
Yeah, it'll get lost. So I want to mention it up front that we have a 6th topic, which is that right before JT Realmuto's single in the 9th inning, John Kruk got cut off from, I think, blowing the lid off a bombshell story about Jim Fregosi and Larry Boa having a system to win at cards. Just something I'd like to hear more about is all.
Why would they cut that off? Yeah, I mean, like, that's silly.
There's saying too much, and then there's saying too little.
Yeah,
and there's being tantalizing like mm-hmm. that, and then not circling back. And you know, I'm sure it's not what people wanted to necessarily talk about in the middle of the greatest Phillies rally we've seen in years. But I gotta tell you, I was left wanting. Without the conclusion of that story, or at least just a further dive into what exactly he meant.
Got to get John Kruk on the podcast. I think that's the only option. That's our only route to getting the rest of that story is to get him on the Hittin' Season podcast. You're right. I feel like we did miss something there, but it was all lost in the shuffle by the time the end of the game on Sunday rolled around. And for good reason, obviously, Kyle Schwarber with a walk-off home run. We're going to get to the comeback specifically here in just a second, but the first topic in our Phillies 5, we're gonna set the lay of the land here for you in terms of where the Phillies stand in the playoffs here on August 24th as they're getting ready again to go to the West Coast and start a series with the Seattle Mariners starting on Monday night. With the sweep of the Cardinals, the Phillies have, of course, won 9 in a row, as you all know by now. It's incredible to remember that at one point this season, this team lost 10 in a row, and now they're on the verge of winning 10 in a row. When I said last week that this team was dizzying, this is what I meant. They are all over the place. You cannot box this team in. You do not know what they are. No one can say for sure that they know what this Phillies team is. They have no boundary. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey in 2010, there was this monolith and it didn't have any surface features. Like you couldn't tell where it started and where it ended. Like it was amorphous. There was no way to get a read on it. The Phillies are the monolith. And I don't mean it like just in general of like, you know, they're overpowering and everything like that, but you can't get a read on this team. There's absolutely no way to do it. They're 16-5 in August after a miserable July. They have won 3 straight series for the first time since 2010. And Sunday had the game of the year with this 4-run comeback by the Phillies in the bottom of the 9th. But as we look at the standings here on Monday morning, after the Braves lost 2 of 3 against the Brewers, they did win on Sunday night. The Phillies are just 3 games behind the Atlanta Braves in the National League East. It was a 9.5 game deficit 12 days ago. There are 31 games to play. It's about 20% of the season left. And the Phillies are only now 2 games behind the Cubs for wild card 1. And that's important. Winning the division or getting the top wild card, even if you're not one of the top 2 seeds, means you get that wild card series at home. So, Justin, I mean, I think the Phillies are setting themselves up here in these last 31 games to give themselves a great run at either one of those two things. I have been kind of telling myself that it was okay for them to kind of be wild card two or wild card three, because it would mean they're still kind of like scratching and clawing to the very last minute to get into the playoffs. And maybe that puts them in a better position than they have the last couple of years when they had, and I never believed in the first round bye nonsense, but you know, you talk yourself into things when a season starts to head in a certain direction. Now, I don't know where we're going. I truly don't know where this team is going to end up. I know they're going to play in October, but how are you feeling right now with the Phillies two games behind the Cubs, three games behind the Braves? They're still a ways away from the Dodgers or the Brewers for one of the top two seeds. I don't have a read. Do not have a read on this team. I'm just enjoying it minute by minute.
Well, first of all, the monolith comp is really accurate because of the bunch of early humans that were shrieking and throwing stuff at it in addition to what it actually is in the movie. But also, there you go, putting them in a box. You know, the team you just said you can't put in a box, and then you immediately pivoted to, so which playoff box do you want to put this team in? It doesn't matter. This is the answer. Either way they go about this could be a positive or a negative. In 2007... getting hot and overtaking the division lead did not help them in the divisional round at all. In 2008, they were 3.5 games out of the division lead on September 10th. Then they got hot and won it again and won the World Series, obviously. And those are two much older comparisons than you even need to make to establish that point when it comes to this team. The momentum of rushing to win the division is great for bragging rights and making the Braves feel bad again, but momentum's no guarantee. We've seen them lose it as soon as it pops up. Maybe there's a sense of finality after they win the division and they burn out. Maybe it's the boost they need to blast through the rest of the postseason. You never know. And winning a wild card spot, there's an argument to be made for them being hungrier and itchier than if they'd won the division. And, you know, given the amount of little injuries that have piled up for this team lately to Luis Arraez and Bryson Stott and Alec Bohm and Derek Hill and how Zach Wheeler's been scuffling a few times out, you can't say a little time off wouldn't be beneficial for this team, too. So both paths offer opportunities and booby traps. And that's before we even know exactly who they're going to be playing, which is a factor in all of this, too. So I think for a team whose playoff berth in general was being questioned 2 weeks ago, making the postseason is the only thing that matters, because look what this team can do when their backs are against the wall. That's what this win and this run have been more important in conveying, is that this team creates its own opportunities and they've made another one here to do something really special.
Yeah, I am not concerned about the first round bye. If they get it, fine. If they don't get it, that's fine too. I would like to get two or three home games in the wild card round, and it would be nice to watch the Braves meltdown over a collapse. I was on Braves Reddit a little bit on Sunday. They are convinced the Phillies are going to hunt them down and overtake them in the National League East. Then they are turning on that club.
Hello, hello, fellow sicko. We must have been shadows passing in the night. I was there. I was also on the Cardinals site trying to read the real-time responses to the loss on Sunday. You know, you got to feed off that stuff immediately. If you don't, you give these people a chance to think about how, well, it's not so bad, or like kind of bounce back or talk about why it's not that big a deal. You got to catch them where the disappointment is real raw and like still devastation. So congratulations, fellow sicko. We really got what we wanted on Sunday too.
Man, it feels nice to swim in that pool sometimes, you know? I mean, it just really feels relaxing and you're just wading in there. I mean, and let's move on to the Phillies five, number two here. And that is the comeback. We got to talk about the comeback. It's his own thing. It's its own vehicle here. There's no way anyone thought that the Phillies are going to pull that out. You get the Harper leadoff double in the bottom of the ninth when you're trailing 4-0. And you think, okay, this is interesting. But then two routine flyouts. I think I saw the Phillies at that point had a 0.4% chance to win that game in that situation. By the time that situation rolled around, trailing by 4 runs with 2 outs in the bottom of the ninth. And in fact, teams were 1-762 this year when trailing by 4 runs entering the ninth inning until the Phillies managed to pull off that feat. You had Harper sitting on second base with the double. Then you had the Realmuto single to center field. That kept the game alive. Justin Crawford, really good at bat from the rookie, working a walk. I think that gets lost in it because he didn't have one of the big hits, but the rookie works the walk there to load the bases for Edmundo Sosa, who hits a ground ball down. A little bit of luck involved too yesterday, because the Phillies got a couple of grounders to the left side that could have found gloves, but Edmundo Sosa places his down the third baseline with the third baseman guarding the line, by the way. It was, I still am not quite sure how that ball got by him. But, and it also missed hitting the abutment where the stands jut out. And if that had happened, yeah.
Well, it kind of reminds you of a certain wild card game where ground balls were just missing gloves and you were like, yes. I don't understand how this is happening, but yeah, let's roll with it.
Yeah, and that's how that went down. So Edmundo Sosa's double goes all the way to the wall, allowing the bases to clear. Now you're at 4-3, and you've got the tying run on second base. And Brian De La Cruz, who we've been talking about, he's been their most productive right-handed hitting outfielder, and really their most productive outfielder overall until Bryce Harper moved to the outfield. He hits a hard hit ground ball single through the hole to score Sosa to tie the game at 4, and then of course Kyle Schwarber comes up. And creates the memory, creates the core memory for millions of Phillies fans to lock away forever to put them ahead 6-4. The first walk-off home run for this team since June 9th of 2023, ending the longest drought in Major League Baseball. Paul Casella noted that every other team in baseball had at least 2 walk-off home runs in between Schwarber's in 2023 and the one that he hit on Sunday. And 4 teams have had at least 10 walk-off home runs in that time frame. So, Justin, I mean, I don't know what to do with it all. I mean, the fact that they already had an 8-game winning streak. They're about ready to board a long flight to Seattle. They were dead all day. There was just no way they were pulling that game out on Sunday afternoon, and they did to push it to 9 in a row. Just incredible.
Yeah, for a team that was rebranding itself as like the Smash the Bell Phillies, it's absolutely staggering that all these other teams have been homering in this capacity, yeah. And the Phillies have not been able to do it for
it's crazy.
Years.
Yeah.
Years and years since it last happened. But like you were saying, it took until watching the celebrations on the field for it to click in my head that, like, yeah, this is a big win, obviously, a huge win that's going to be, like, the win that's being talked about even on, like, the MLB recap shows and the national shows and everything. Like, this is the win of the day. This is probably the win of the year for the Phillies. But as they're celebrating, it kind of clicked in my head that that's an iconic Phillies win.
Yeah.
That's, like you're saying, that's one people are going to remember. And it's singular, you know, it's just one game and all that. But at the same time, that's what's part of these eras where the team is like good. And, you know, we all have had plenty of issues with this team, certainly this year and in years prior. And we all know they haven't won the ultimate goal yet. But the way we talk about them coming back to beat the Reds in that game where Greg Dobbs and Cody Ransom hit home runs, and the game you and I are always talking about with being down 9-0 on the Dodgers, and then Carlos Ruiz double walks it off for them after they come have that huge comeback. Even something like the Cal Stevenson game 2 years ago at Citizens Bank Park against the Mets, where he homered and robbed the Mets of a home run. It's one of those regular season games that people are going to remember this forever. And the way this team plays, sometimes you don't think they're going to hit a peak like that until they do. And they showed you something today that, like, this team that kind of has looked like they are, you know, when we know how they look when they're struggling, and they've been struggling. And when they are, it feels so far from success. A win like this feels unattainable. But here they are, winning 9 games in a row, like finishing off this sweep that it seemed like, yeah, you know, they don't play well during day games. We've seen them look a little sleepy in these finale games where they're you know, going to get on the road. Well, they're not going on the road, but like they're just wrapping up a series. And yeah, and there's like no harm in losing that game, especially if you're going to keep winning after it. Like, yeah, but they managed to pull it off this time. And you know, you can apply a bunch of meaning to that, or you can just look at what literally happened and say, like, there's a team in there that's capable of winning this big game in exciting fashion. And having that confirmed, you know, this close to the postseason, we still got like 30 so games left, but this close to the postseason in the stretch run, it's just a great thing for people to see, and more importantly for the team to experience and to be like, all right, look, we can do this. We can be this. We are a playoff team, even if we lost 6 of 8 series after the All-Star break.
Yeah, you could have excused a listless performance on Sunday that resulted in a loss, given the fact they'd won 8 in a row. They were dealing with injuries. Like you mentioned, Alec Bohm was nicked up. Bryson Stott hurt himself midway through the game, fouling a ball off his foot. You had Luis Arraez, who was hurt. Derek Hill was hurt. They just had a lot of guys who weren't available, who just weren't were kind of banged up. You know, they're getting ready to go on this long trip to Seattle. I think it's a 6-hour flight from Philadelphia to Seattle to start this series out there. And so you could have forgiven the team for having kind of a blah Sunday. Christopher Sanchez wasn't terribly sharp, not bad, but also not terribly sharp on Sunday. And you could have very easily just chalked it up to, well, you know, okay, put this one in the rearview mirror and let's head to Seattle and we'll start a new winning streak. And the fact that they didn't do that, the fact that they found a way to battle back in the ninth inning, I think that's where, and we're going to talk about the offense as a whole coming up here, but I think that's where this recent trend of these guys putting together more quality at bats had it benefited them in the ninth inning on Sunday. Like they couldn't do anything offensively for eight innings on Sunday, but the quality of the at bats in the ninth inning resurfaced, and the kinds of disciplined plate appearances that the Phillies were having during the course of this entire winning streak and during the course of this month of August, they manifested themselves in that rally on Sunday. And that's, if there's anything that makes you feel good about their chances improving in October, it's that. It's you didn't have a bunch of guys up there trying to swing for the 5-run home run, right? You had guys who were up there just get a single, pass the baton, work a walk, pass the baton. Edmundo Sosa didn't swing at a single pitch in the strike zone in his plate appearance. It's just, he's not going to be one of those guys. Him and Trey Turner are not going to join the discipline parade, but he's gotten hot. And when he gets like this, you just kind of ride it. Jeff Kerr noted that the Phillies were down to their final strike 9 times on Sunday. 9 times they were down to their final strike. They had 2 strike counts on each of their 5 hits in the ninth inning. And to just kind of talk about what this team has been able to do late in games, the Phillies have 5 wins this year after trailing with 2 outs and 2 strikes in the ninth inning. They did it on April 1st, April 30th, June 23rd, June 24th, and on Sunday. OptiStats, notes that it's the most such wins by any major league team in a single season since pitches were first tracked in 1988. So I don't know what other little bows to put on that rally on Sunday, other than you're unlikely to ever see anything like that again. And for those folks who were in attendance yesterday, for those of you who stuck it out and stayed till the last pitch, you were rewarded for your discipline as a fan, sticking to your seats throughout that whole game. Congratulations to you and to the poor St. Louis Cardinals fans who were there. There was a couple that they capture in the highlights, and the one woman's just smiling. She's like, what are you going to do? My hat's off to her, because she was just like, it's over. You know, what are you going to do? What can you say? Good job by her.
We've seen enough footage of Phillies fans in that scenario to have earned that. I mean, and I also love the NBC Sports broadcast does a really good job of hunting for opposing fans in those moments and picking them out. But I got to tell you, the shot of Riley O'Brien.
Yes, I was going to say that.
St. Louis closer is.
He's just like,
that's rough. You know, as we were saying earlier, that's obviously something you and I are going to take an immense amount of enjoyment from. And the screen cap of that was certainly making its way around Philly's social media as well. But boy, you see the look on his face and you're like, yeah, usually the closer, you know, he'll just walk off the field without looking, or he'll just kind of remain stoic, like serious, like stone faced and stoic. And like maybe goes back to the dugout, throws his glove on his way down the hall. I think you kind of rarely see a closer with the abject horror on his face the way Riley O'Brien had on his face, just knowing the implications of everything that had just happened and him already being a challenging pitcher for Cardinals fans to watch in late innings. There were plenty of Cardinals fans who were calling this like, all right, well, you know, postseason's out, and other fans who were saying like, well, it was just a 5-6 road trip. It's like not that bad, but
they're 8.5 out of the last wild card right now. They're done.
Yeah, you can tell there's a lot of cope coming in there for the positive side of that. And O'Brien is, he's unfortunately going to be the face of that given his reaction to that home run. But like, can't blame him. That's exactly how everybody would be feeling if they were the one who gave up a 459-foot home run that went so far the cameras couldn't even catch it.
Nope, they had no idea where it was on first viewing, because it was above where the camera shot was. Really just incredible onto Ashburn Alley. I question why he was still in the game. He was approaching 40 pitches in that ninth inning. Relief pitchers don't generally throw that many pitches. Why was there not someone else warming up at some point in that inning? Did it just happen too fast, do you think?
I think they not have somebody start warming up?
Maybe it was too late.
Maybe when he issued the walk to load the bases. I don't know.
Yeah.
I could be remembering that wrong. But yeah, I mean, you sound like a lot of the Cardinals fans.
Yeah, just from go get him. The
same exact way. He went out there. Well, somebody went out there. And, yeah. You know, did not. It was like one of those moments. Like, wow, he's staying in. Except instead of being impressed, you were like, why is this happening?
That's right. So, all right, tremendous win on Sunday, and really it was a tremendous weekend overall. The Phillies on Saturday won 12-3, and then there was a lost in the shuffle, a pretty impressive 10th inning comeback on Friday night, winning 7-6. We'll get to that game in just a second, but I want to talk next on this Phillies 5. Topic number 3 is Andrew Painter, one of the other big stories to come out of the weekend, Justin. He had his best major league start ever. On Saturday night, it was the kind of start where you finally said to yourself, oh, that's where the top prospect Andrew Painter is. It's we finally saw that guy for the first time on a big league mound. 7 innings, 1 earned run, no walks, and 8 strikeouts for Andrew Painter. He hit just under 100 miles an hour on a fastball on his 100th pitch of the game. It's the first time he's ever gone 7 innings in a game. He generated 20 whiffs on 60 swings, a 33% whiff rate, which is a career high. His previous high was 14. And just as importantly, he threw 22 of 27 first pitch strikes. The fastball is moving more. It's got more vertical drop. It's the velocity is where it needs to be. In his 5 starts since returning from the minors, he has a 3.62 ERA and has allowed 2 earned runs or less in 4 of those 5 starts. And the most important change is that since he's come back from the minors, he's ditched his split finger pitch for a new circle change. And that has made all the difference in the world. It's helped his fastball. It's helped him against left-handers. And now he's out there looking like a guy who believes he's a top prospect, who believes he's a potential top of the rotation starter. So I'm not ready to say Andrew Painter's that guy yet. I don't know what we're going to get from him during the course of the regular season. The trend line is obviously pointing up. But Justin, has top prospect Andrew Painter finally arrived in Philadelphia?
This is the most arrived that I think Painter has ever looked as a major leaguer. That's a Cardinals lineup that obviously hasn't been performing super well, but you know, JJ Weatherholt's a rookie of the year contender. Alec Burleson's been on a real heater lately, and obviously nobody likes pitching to Jordan Walker. So there were some really tough outs in that lineup for Painter to get. He got 5 Cardinals swinging and sat a little over 97 on the fastball with a generous helping of movement in there as well. So
yeah, up in the zone, it was really good. Yeah.
That alone is what you want to see from Andrew Painter. The pitch is his fastball is missing bats, it feels like, for the first time this season.
Yeah.
He was not successfully doing that a few months ago. He put the splitter away and brought out a changeup since coming back from the minors, and he got a lot of swings and misses on that primarily as well. So on the whole, it's what we said, which was that Painter looked too broken to actually be broken. Like, there was too much wrong with a guy who had been way too good to not have some part of what he was going through be fixable. So he may have been struggling to adjust. He needed to tweak something, had to get his head right. But Painter was too young and, frankly, too recovered from his injury to not be able to throw a fastball. That's a pretty steep drop off from being the best pitching prospect in the country. So here we are. It took patience and time that none of us wanted to use, but Painter is serving the purpose, at the very least, of a back of the rotation starter, giving them 7 innings of work to keep the bullpen fresh and eat through these dog days section of the schedule. And the offense did their job for him too and piled up a bunch of run support, which wasn't always the case before either. Painter pitching well really lets the Phillies breathe, which can only make them better. And yeah, I think this was his best start in the majors so far. He's kind of been hinting at a start like this for the last couple of starts. This is what you wanted to see. And honestly, I don't need him to pitch like a top of the rotation starter. If he wants to like start making that push, that'd be great too. But he really just needs to like be a guy who pitches well enough and eats a bunch of innings. And I think they would still call this season a win.
Yeah, Dave Dombrowski did not trade him at the trade deadline. A lot of fans wanted him to be traded or were very much willing to have him be traded. I was one of them. I still will not back off of trading prospects. I think it's the right thing to do most of the time. That being said, Andrew Painter, if he pitches like this, it'll have been a very good thing that the Phillies didn't end up dealing him at the trade deadline. We'll see how it all works out. I think the thing that was super impressive with him on Sunday was his last inning. He really wanted to go seven innings, and the Phillies had a big lead at the time, so they could push him a little bit. But in the seventh inning, after a Trey Turner throwing error, he had runners on second and third with one out. And Don Mattingly and Caleb Cotham decided, let's push the kid. Let's see if he can get out of this, because he had been pitching with so much confidence. He had been pitching with more aggression during the course of even these last few starts before Sunday. And he took advantage of the opportunity and managed to wiggle out of that jam without giving up a run and finished seven innings. I mean, that even just pitching seven innings, even if it was a breeze, would have been a huge deal. But to have to fight his way through that seventh inning unscathed, that's a huge learning experience. And if he's pitching in the playoffs for this team in some capacity, he's going to be able, and he's going to have to, rely on that experience to help him get through a sticky wicket in October or even later this month. If there's a pennant race, then, and the Phillies are really needing a win and Andrew Painter is in a tough spot and they need him to come through in a situation, he knows he can do it. He's built that muscle memory. He's built that confidence in himself to be able to get through a tight situation, to know, I do have this stuff. I know how to use it. I can trust my catcher to help me through it, and I can get through a difficult situation. I thought that as much as the stuff, the learning experience of getting through that inning was enormous on Saturday night.
It's a small thing, but when he gave up, he had two outs in the sixth, and he gave up a single to Alec Burleson that knocked in the Cardinals' first run of the day, and then he wound up, you know, getting out of that inning no problem as well pretty quickly after that. But the shot of him in slow motion going to commercial was he was screaming into his glove, which is a version of him I had not seen yet. I mean, that was, in a way, that's good to see too. It makes him look more like a major leaguer. It really looks, he's like, he hated that he gave that run up. Hated it. And it just was like, before, what success was for Andrew Painter was a much lower bar. And it just indicated that he has raised that bar for himself as well, where he's like, yeah, I'm not giving that run up. And then it comes in and he's ticked off. And that's, again, that's good to see from a guy who, yeah, like you said, could be pitching in the postseason. You want to see a kid not only rise to the occasion and start pitching better, but also just, yeah, have that kind of intensity to him, because he's going to need it.
Was this the most important development of the weekend? I mean, I know the offense doing its thing was really important, and obviously the win on Sunday was what everybody's going to remember from this weekend. But I would postulate Andrew Painter's emergence is the most important development. That start is the most important development for this team for the rest of the year, because I don't know how they'll utilize him in the playoffs, but even having a number five starter who you can kind of depend on more than you have at any point this season allows the Phillies to not go into every fifth game with a scheduled loss. And it also gives you a potential weapon for the bullpen in October. Like, if he can continue to use this new arsenal, it's a three pitch mix for him right now. That'll play up as a reliever in the playoffs, if he's just kind of going one inning or two innings or something like that. To me, this is the most important development of the weekend in terms of the Phillies' prognosis for success as the season rolls along.
Well, you know, baseball is a three-headed snake that never stops eating itself, so I don't think it's super fair to be splitting up the progress in both areas. You can't really choose one of those without being wrong about the other one. On the one hand, with this team leaning real, real hard on its rotation for so long this year and just hoping the offense and bullpen will come through, it feels very important to see the lineup score enough to win nine straight games and come back from various deficits, including 4-0 with two outs in the ninth. Knowing your offense is capable of that may not take pressure off the starter in that moment, as he's been waiting all day for some backup, but it does win you a game that a few months ago you probably lose. And on the other hand, Painter was a big part of this team's plans in 2026. It's late August, but him finally looking like this encouraging starter, pitching effectively as a big leaguer, making his fundamental pitch work for strikes and bringing out some new stuff in response to what wasn't working, that's a huge development for this team's stretch run, as guys like Wheeler and Sanchez look a little more human, and for the future, which seemed a lot bleaker for Painter not too long ago. So I think that might be the biggest difference between these two things. Like, we know this offense will come and go. We're going to be hearing about like that late July hitters meeting until the end of the season where everybody yeah. decided, yeah, I guess we shouldn't swing at pitches 2 feet out of the zone, except for some notable exceptions. That's something that will come and go, as we know. And a lot of these guys are seasoned veteran hitters in their mid-30s. But in the case of Painter, who is young, most of his career is still ahead of him. That makes him kind of an outlier on this team. So to see him figure something out is probably a bigger deal for this team's longer-term future than the other developments. But in the here and now, both of these are just so crucial to this team's success. I don't want to pick one over the other.
Yeah, I hear you, and that's fine, and that's totally fair. Let's move on to the fourth topic of the Phillies five here from the weekend, and I want to talk about Friday night starter Jesus Luzardo, who has been this team's best pitcher over the last couple of months. He gave up some runs in the game on Friday night on a couple of home runs, but overall still continued to look like one of the best pitchers in baseball, and right now the hottest pitcher on this team. And really want to talk about kind of looking at his tenure in Philadelphia. In two seasons here with the Phillies, Jesus Luzardo is 26-12 with a 3.66 ERA. He's averaging 10.9 strikeouts per nine and just 2.8 walks per nine. Opponents are hitting just 229 against him this year. Last year, it was 240. And if you look at his overall numbers going back to last year, and you look at Fangraphs wins above replacement, which tends to favor fielding independent pitching over ERA. So his numbers on Fangraphs are going to be higher than, say, Baseball Reference. His 9.9 wins above replacement is tied for third best in Major League Baseball over the last 2 years with Tarek Skubal. Only Paul Skeens with 10.2 and Christopher Sanchez, the best pitcher in baseball over the last 2 years, according to Fangraphs at 11.6, have more wins above replacement. He's second in strikeouts over the last 2 years with 410, fourth in innings, which is saying something for a guy where you had injury concerns about him when you first traded for him. He's fourth in fielding independent pitching and 13th in batting average allowed. I found it amazing that, according to Fangraphs, he's been as valuable as Tarek Skubal over the last 2 years. And the fact that the Phillies gave up Starlin Cabba and Amarian Boyd for him, Cabba's still in high A, like a 774 OPS. Boyd is 23. He's got a 655 OPS in double A. They signed him to a 5-year contract extension for $135 million. Think how much money Tarek Skubal is going to get this offseason as a free agent. And Tarek Skubal's a better pitcher than Jesus Luzardo. I'm not trying to tell you that he's not. But in terms of overall productivity and price and what you had to give to give up to get him, I'm not so sure that I think Jesus Luzardo is the best acquisition and maybe the best signing, maybe outside of Christopher Sanchez, but the best signing the Phillies have made during Dave Dombrowski's tenure. It's just incredible how he has come to the forefront as a true top line starter.
Yeah, and yeah, again, this feels like a complete reversal given the conversation around Dombrowski, specifically in regards to who he has and hasn't acquired for this team just several weeks ago. But regardless, I mean, we can go down the list, and I feel like I still agree with you, though there is a name I want to throw in at the end. But, you know, you got Brandon Marsh, fluctuating hitter, has been better than he ever was with the Angels since Dombrowski got him. So I give him extra points for that because Marsh was a better fit here than he was in Anaheim, and that was something that got pointed out by the Phillies and their hitting staff before they acquired him. That being said, Brandon Marsh is Brandon Marsh. We know where his flaws are. Luis Arraez is a huge addition to this lineup. He hasn't even been here that long. Automatic hitting style nobody else in the team or the league has, and he was acquired at a time when the Phillies had very specific needs and no obvious way to meet those needs. So like they did with Luzardo, they just kind of went for a guy who was available and could help, despite not being the exact puzzle piece that they were looking for, and the results have still been, you know, very good. Turns out when you just acquire really good players, they probably just continue being very good for you, even though he did undergo, again, the longest slump of his season after he put on a Phillies uniform at first. Regardless, Trey Turner should probably be the answer to this question in a fair and just world, but he's not. He's had such a rough and wobbly ride here, you simply can't say that. And that's even, like, putting aside the defensive stuff. So I got to say, Luzardo is probably, the best acquisition Dombrowski has made. I do want to throw the name Edmundo Sosa out there.
That's a great one.
a different role, you know, totally different set of rules and context and everything. But he looks occasionally like he's trying to kill a housefly when he's swinging up there in big spots. But it's got to be said that a utility guy who plays at Sosa's level, adds 60, 70 hits, 20, 30 extra base hits to your output every season, and helps keep this team's foot on the gas pedal while providing them depth, which is something we repeatedly say they do not have at multiple positions, is irreplaceable. So, like Marsh, like Sosa, I think Lizardo has really found himself in Philadelphia. But, and again, you give Dombrowski points for noticing a guy who's like, yeah, seems like there's some like potential bubbling over the surface here. Miami is just at the moment not a place where guys thrive a whole lot. And in Lizardo's case, I think it's both the skill and the business tact Dave Dombrowski used in acquiring him, given how little the Phillies had to give up to improve an area of their team that was already a strength. Even when this team is scraping bottom, people point to their rotation as a playoff as like playoff ready. And without Lizardo, you can't say that.
No, not at all. And I think the Phillies have three guys you could start a game one and feel good about. And Jesus Cesardo is one of them right now, which is we had people calling for him to go to the bullpen earlier this year to help with the left-handed reliever issue. I think we can safely put that idea to bed moving forward, even though the reliever issue is still an issue. There's still issues. It's the weakest part of the team. There's still problems
we're never going to lose and we're going to live forever. Come on.
True enough. All right. Topic five on the Phillies five from this nine game winning streak. I got to finish off talking about the offense, and we could talk about Luis Arraez as well. You mentioned the fact that the Phillies' new second baseman had an 0-for-17 slump during his time here with the Phillies. He's still hitting .311 for them since coming to Philadelphia. That's with an 0-for-17. Arraez is hitting .311 for the Phillies through the 18 games that he has had with them. And overall as a team, entering August, the Phillies had the worst on-base percentage in baseball. Everybody knows this by now, .303. Their .370 on-base percentage this month is still tops in baseball, and it is a number that defies logic. It is the club's best on-base percentage in a month going back to July of 2007, when it was .385. Over 21 games in August, the Phillies offense ranks number one in the majors in on-base percentage at .370 and in walks at .99. They are second in batting average at .283 and in runs scored with 122. And of course, they lead all of baseball with 16 wins this month. They also have the lowest strikeout rate in Major League Baseball at 14.7% in the month of August. Now, this started a little bit before Luis Arraez got here. And Arraez's profile, he's not a high walk rate guy, right? But he is a high contact guy. He is a high strikeout guy. He does put together competitive at-bats nearly every time. And I've been asked this question when I've gone on the radio, on other podcasts. I'm sure you have as well. And it's a question I just don't know the answer to. And I haven't heard your thoughts on this yet, so I wanted to throw this your way. With Luis Arraez coming to Philadelphia, how much of an impact do you think he has had on this lineup and the approach that these players have taken at the plate? We know that we've heard that this goes back to a meeting the team had at the end of July, but we really started to see these changes in August after Luis Arraez arrived. I mean, maybe he was just kind of the poster child for what everybody was saying the Phillies needed to do more, and they needed a visual representation of it to say, oh, that's what they were talking about.
Think back to that story from we were talking about, I think, last year with the Ryan Howard Phillies, and they had a hitters meeting, and I forget what the impetus of it was, but I think it was something with the pitching staff, because they were like, okay, we really got to like get it together here because we got to be the strength of this team for this stretch.
Right.
And I was like, so what? They can just decide to do that? They can just have a meeting and be like, okay, let's start hitting? Why aren't they just doing that all the time? And, you know, flash forward a couple of months, and there was a point in time where people were clamoring for Jerks and Profar to be the acquisition for this team because he succeeds in that, you know, plate discipline way that the Phillies typically don't. And it was laughable to consider that acquiring one guy would just suddenly have this ripple effect through the lineup, and they would all just suddenly start having healthier and more reasonable plate approaches and everything. That got dismissed in hand by us and, you know, beat writers who were like, I mean, look, there's limits to the reality of that. Like, come on. These are major league hitters. They have their routines. They have their way, especially with Nick Castellanos here. He was like, I hit the way I hit, and that's never going to change. Yeah. So that's a key difference, I think, honestly, in some respects, that that the hitters who did not want to change are less in the lineup. Like you said, some guys like Sosa are just never going to change. But Arise is having exactly the kind of impact we said he wouldn't.
We said that about him. Exactly.
So if you want to credit him in combination with that meeting, I'm sure it was, yes, a combination of things. But it is crazy to see that they all have largely an approach that is similar to his own, with this, that like slow, decisive, but in after careful evaluation of a pitch, you know, choosing to swing, laying off stuff. I mean, what are this team's numbers? This team's ability to select pitches now have just gotten so much healthier and efficient, and like they look more comfortable with two strikes. Like it's completely flipping it. And who knows? Maybe that is just seeing that and having a hitter like Arise around. You know, they don't have to be picking his brain to kind of see, you know, an example. Definitely the best example of the kind of, you know, contact, generational contact hitter that Arise is. Maybe, you know, that could very well be having the impact. It could also be this, you know, this meeting where they got a lot of stuff out in the open and everybody talked and Kevin Long's hitting staff was there. But it's got to be a combination of all of it. You know, it all happened around the same time. It all feeds into the same kind of success. And the important thing is, again, proving once again that they can change, because we've seen them like lock it up before and have more efficient at bats. And then eventually that erodes a bit and they kind of hit that natural state again. But, you know, maybe this has a little bit of a longer standing success rate, because it's not just a meeting. It's also having the best contact hitter of his generation in their lineup every day.
Yeah, and the results have been there too, which tells you that they're doing something that's the hardest thing to do, which is to develop plate discipline. Even in an off season, you can't really do it. At the end of after 4 months, they just decide, okay, yeah, we're going to decide to be more disciplined at the plate. Alec Bohm's a guy who you've seen this really come through in spades, because that 10th inning at bat that he had on Friday night, we have seen him first pitch swing in those types of situations all the time. It, even as recently as 3 weeks ago, he was driving us crazy with his incessant desire to smash every first pitch sinker into the ground for a double play. And on Friday night, he took a few pitches, right? He took a first pitch out of the strike, a little bit out of the strike zone, or maybe it was in the strike zone, but it was a called strike. And then the next two pitches were out of the strike zone. He eventually saw enough pitches so that the ball that he hit that was not caught in center field was a hanging breaking ball right down the middle of the plate. And that's the whole point of trying to be patient, is not going after a pitcher's first pitch when the pitcher is most in control of the at-bat is on the first pitch. They have decided this is going to be my plan of attack. This is going to be how I'm going to go after this hitter. When a pitcher gets down like 1-2 or is in a count like 2-2 or something, now he's figuring things out on the fly with the catcher, and that's where mistakes can happen. Now, it can be said sometimes pitchers are going to give you a first pitch get them over fastball, that if you're an astute hitter and you want to ambush one of those things, you do that. And certainly at some point this year, pitchers are going to adjust. They're going to stop living outside the strike zone with the Phillies if they continue to be really patient, and they're going to start pounding the strike zone with more strikes. And I think as they see better pitching in the playoffs, Jacob Mizrowski doesn't need to live outside the strike zone as much as some of these other pitchers do. Same thing with a lot of the Dodgers starters. Yamamoto doesn't need to do that. But being able to look at pitches, being able to work counts, enables you to see the mistakes when they come. And even in Kyle Schwarber's plate appearance yesterday, it was like pitch 6 or 7. He fouled a couple balls off. He took a couple of pitches. They were kind of uncompetitive balls that he took out of the strike zone. But there was one pitch. It was 0-2, and he threw a breaking ball down at the bottom of the zone. And Schwarber flinched. He almost went around on it and managed to hold up, and then saw another 2 or 3 pitches before he got a mistake pitch up in the zone that he was able to hit out. That's just... I'm hopeful that if they have this approach in October, it is going to be different, because that isn't what we've seen from them in October's past. But again, we can't predict it. We can't feel like we've got it. You know, it just doesn't feel like we know that.
Among other things, I just want to throw it out there that I think Kyle Schwarber is the best check swinger in baseball.
Yes.
that is part of like his great plate approach.
Yeah.
And it's invaluable because, you know, a guy like Kyle Schwarber, yeah, he can hit the ball 459 feet, but not if he's swinging at everything, you know, not if he's a total mess up there.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a huge, huge development. And I love seeing the Phillies just take these more healthy, streamlined at bats where it's like, yeah, you're tricked less, you know, just being a team that's harder to fool at the plate is like, yeah, this is eventually the Cardinals started game three playing real aggressive. They were first yeah. pitch swinging. They were stealing bases. They got on the board first for that reason. You know, and again, their ground balls were finding holes to start game three as well. Obviously, that is a tactic that can work. And we've all seen what being aggressive looks like when the Phillies do it, when they succeed, and when they don't, they look sloppy and then they look silly. But that's just how that looks. In this case, where you're just making that adjustment to like take that extra second to be okay with being down in the count, with being able to see pitches and like come up to the plate with a plan. Like if you want to listen to a radio broadcast, you hear Larry Anderson bring this up all season long. Got to go to the yeah. plate with a plan. You know, hitting expert Larry Anderson talking about the plan you need going yeah. to the plate. But regardless, you can see the difference in doing that because, yeah, you can't win down 4-0 with 2 outs in the ninth without healthy plate approaches. And I say that knowing that Edmundo Sosa and Brian De La Cruz both had big hits that came on pitches outside of the zone. But yeah. In Schwarber's case, yeah, he got to wait. He knows exactly what he is doing up there, and he knows exactly what kind of pitch he's waiting for, and he knows that he's going to have to see a few before he gets it. He got the mistake he was hoping for, and then everyone said he was admiring that home run. I read that more as like, he's like, I got the pitch I wanted. I hit it like I wanted. Now let's just see what happens.
Yeah, he knew he had it, but I think he said after the game that he didn't mean to show anybody up, but he was kind of in disbelief as he watched it mm-hmm. as he watched it flying out of the ballpark. And
plan no one came together.
Yeah, exactly. The plan came together, and no one's going to have a problem with Kyle. He wasn't pimping the home run, but he did have quite a bat flip and a helmet toss there, and I don't think many players would be upset with that. On Players Weekend, it's a good player celebration. I think Tom McCarthy said it really well. They're celebrating like kids on Players Weekend, and that was kind of a fun moment from Tom McCarthy. So that was my Phillies five from the weekend, Justin. Those are the five big things. Anything that caught your attention during the weekend that we haven't mentioned that you wanted to bring up?
No, I mean, no. I feel like we hit all of these.
Hit the notes.
Yeah, all the notes I had. Yeah, yeah, I mean, there's okay. a lot of fun details going into this game. And yeah, like you said, stuff like the Crawford at bat, like there's in a win like this, things will get overlooked. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, this was a big team win. And
yeah.
that was also good to see because this is a team that has, you know, for long stretches of time relied on like certain individuals or small groups of the team. To see like full team wins here a couple of times throughout this hot streak has also been very good to see. So morale should be as high as it's been all season, if not higher right now.
Absolutely.
Especially as you hit the road, and yeah, you don't always like when the Phillies go west, but this is a very beatable stretch. This is a very winnable stretch of games out west for the Phillies, with the Mariners, Angels, and Diamondbacks. So this is where you want to be going into September, yeah. and the Phillies are there.
Yeah, the AL West is a nightmare. Every team has a negative run differential, and not by just a little bit. The best run differential of any team in the American League West is the Astros at -44. So it's an entire... It's an entire division where everyone is under 500. Everyone is under 500 in that division. The Mariners are 62-69 and just 3 games back of the Astros and Rangers, who are both tied for first place at 65-66. So you're right. They get a beatable Mariners team and an even more beatable Angels team before they go play the Diamondbacks in a big wild card matchup.
Ooh. Just should have fist bumped Randy Arozarena, bud. Look what happened.
Yeah. Yep.
Bad mojo.
Terrible mojo. Yep, it really did just destroy the season. Really unbelievable. All right, any Justin, final thoughts for you as we wrap up one of the most fun episodes we have done this year with a team that I hope everybody is getting on board just to enjoy this regular season because it's been a lot of fun.
Just that we have a new Dirty Inning over at the Patreon. It is about 19th. Is actually a listener request for the game in 1961 where Gene Mock had a starting lineup with four pitchers in it. And we get into exactly why that happened and how it worked and why the Phillies lost anyway, because it was a classic Gene Mock strategy in that capacity. So we had a lot of fun doing that. That's over at the Patreon right now. And then over at Baseball Prospectus, I wrote a post-trade deadline version of the of a general manager text thread between all the Major League Baseball GMs. So they all... My editor loves that format.
Yeah, those are great.
So I wrote one of those again, and that's over at Baseball Prospectus, and that was a lot of fun too.
And don't forget to buy Justin's book, Summer of the Cheap Wieners. I can never remember the subtitle. What the 1941 mm-hmm. Phillies were up to while Joe DiMaggio was making history. Go buy this book. It's really a lot of fun. You'll really like it if you haven't done it yet. Go buy the book. And folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. If you want to watch the podcast and you've only listened to it in the past, have no fear. You can find us over at the WHYY YouTube channel. Just subscribe to the WHYY YouTube channel and you'll get every roundtable edition of the podcast feeding onto your TV, your tablet, your smartphone, however it is you like to watch your podcast. But if you're still one of those folks that listens only and you listen on Apple Podcasts, please give the show a rating and a 5-star review. We really would love to hear what you have to say about the show, hear any ideas that you have, and you can always email the show, hittinseason@billypenn.com. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.